Billy Rose was a low rider. Billy Rose was a night fighter. Billy Rose knew trouble like the sound of his own name. Busted on a drunken charge, driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. I believe he fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. Home, come and lay, help us lay young Billy down. Lulu was a Mexican, the law calls an alien for coming across the border with a baby and a wife. While the clothes upon his back were wet, still he thought that he could get some money and things to start a life. It hadn't been too very long when it seemed like everything went wrong. Didn't even have the time to find themselves a home. When this foreigner, a brown-skinned male, thrown inside a Texas jail, left the wife and baby quite alone. Kilowatt was an aging con of 65 who stood a chance to stay alive and leave the joint and walk the streets again. As the time he was to leave drew near, he suffered all the joy and fear of leaving 35 years in the pen. By the police, who took him to the warden, walking slowly by his side. The warden said, "You won't remain here, but it seems a state retainer claims another 10 years of your life."
Welcome to Prison Pipeline. Thank you for listening with us to Joan Baez singing the Prison Trilogy, one of the favorite songs of our dear Ann Rose Pierce that we lost last year. We're getting near Mother's Day, so today's program is going to have a little slant towards Mother's Day. I've extended it to include Father's Day also. And I'm Ruth Kovach. I co-host with Reggae Bob. For now, we're going to start with the Mamiya playing that we do on almost every program.
This fear of a brown America. The simmering struggle over immigration continues to bubble over the congressional vacation, and after all is said and done, it is doubtful in the extreme that they have the solution. The contending bills, each more repressive than the last, are all less to do with the proper status of immigrants than with the attempt to further whiten the U.S. If we turn back the clock, we see echoes of this whitening trend throughout American history. Back in the 1920s, during the heyday of the Ku Klux Klan, the racist U.S. Congress set formal immigration quotas, which, according to historian Howard Zinn, opened the doors to whites and slammed the door on millions of people of color. In his classic work, A People's History of the United States, Zinn writes, Congress, in the 20s, put an end to the dangerous, turbulent flood of immigrants, 14 million between 1900 and 1920, by passing laws setting immigration quotas. The quotas favored Anglo-Saxons, kept out black and yellow people, limited severely the coming of Latins, Slavs, and Jews. No African country could send more than 100 people. 100 was the limit for China, for Bulgaria, for Palestine. 34,007 could come from England or Northern Ireland, but only 3,845 from Italy. 51,227 from Germany, but only 124 from Lithuania. 28,567 from the Irish Free State, but only 2,248 from Russia. In the 1930s, the U.S. government forcibly expelled some 2 million people of Mexican ancestry from the country. That, according to a California state senator, Senator Joe Dunn argues that of that number, some 60% were U.S. citizens, most of whom were born in this country. Because many of them couldn't speak English, they were wrongfully deported. Those people were deported because they weren't white. Indeed, many of them claimed to have left voluntarily. But in truth, they were forced out by racist harassment and ethnic intimidation. In the words of a Los Angeles director of immigration recorded in 1931, thousands upon thousands of Mexican aliens have been literally scared out of Southern California. For those Mexican Americans who defied these deportations, intimidations, and harassment, there was another hurdle, best expressed by the slogan of LA's Chamber of Commerce, quote, employ no Mexican while a white man is unemployed, unquote. The kicker, of course, was by this time America was gripped in the Great Depression, and there weren't many men, white, black, or brown, who had a job that paid. We like to think that was then, this is now. We look back at those days as if they were somehow different than we. We are different, but it doesn't mean we are better. The same political will to appeal to the worst in us suffuses the political bodies that claim to speak in our names. The same us versus them instinct drives national policy. The same repressive nature is reflected in the words and tone of proposed legislation. We have not gone as far as we think we have. We don't speak as openly as they did some 80 years ago, but the meanings and objectives are exactly the same. There are forces at work in this nation that dread the growth of a brown America, even if over a third of this country was originally Mexican territory. If Canadians were forced over the northern border to feed and support their families, the predominant view would be, how can we help? How many hundreds of thousands of people, no, how many millions were forced into exile because of the repression of their armies by troops taught how to torture in the school of the Americas? The best way to impact immigration is to cease this nation's meddling in the affairs of nations in Latin America, or else the flood will only rise. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Hello again, this is Ruth Kovach. I'm back with you. I want to connect coming Mother's Day and extend it to Father's Day and children visiting their incarcerated parents. And it brought to my mind, after hearing Mumia, a poem that I wrote about Mumia. So with your patience, I'll read that for you today. Longing for a glimpse of daylight, deprived of the touch of those who loved him, he watched his screaming daughter through the glass that separated them. "Why can't he hold me?" she begged. "Why can't my daddy touch me? Why can't we free him?" we cry. "We cannot let him be executed. We know his strength, we know his pain. Wounded in the streets so long ago, beaten while down and bleeding, chained while in a hospital robe, not allowed to hear the lies and witnesses who feared for their lives, condemned to death by the prejudice and anger of Judge Szabo, he paces the floor of his lonely cell, walking in a dizzy circle. Over 20 years he knew he was in hell. He's still in hell. He's still isolated. But he continues to be the voice of the voiceless. We continue to demonstrate our outrage, and they continue to tell their lies, to turn their backs, to obstruct justice, to block his freedom. Why can't we free him? What must we do? It could happen to us, you know, today or tomorrow. We march, we weep, we will be heard, he will be freed. We cannot stop. We do it for our own safety, not just for him. We do it for justice. We do it for our children. For 20 years, they have perpetuated the injustice system, defied the Constitution, escalated our anger, violated our principles, insulted our intelligence. We must not stop now. We cannot stop. Free Mamiya, or God help us all. I kind of found that those words that I wrote about 6 years ago are still very pertinent. And in thinking about the Mother's Day that's coming, I'd like to give you a little bit of data about parents who are incarcerated. I have to scramble for some notes here. Excuse me. Okay, sorry for that delay. State prisoners who are parents are less likely to be violent offenders. 44% of the inmates without children, or 51% of the prisoners who were parents from a prior conviction, are some of the statistics that tell us that those prisoners who have children are better prisoners and less likely to be violent. Of the nation's 72 million minor children, 17 years old and younger, an estimated 2% have an incarcerated parent. Now, I once told you when we were talking about women in prison that 167,000 children in the United States have incarcerated mothers. But the total is almost 1.5 million minor children have an incarcerated parent in prison, which is an increase of more than 500,000 children since 1991. So this is what has me thinking today. Mother's Day is coming, and what I really want you to do is to think about getting a visitor to someone who's incarcerated, a mother or a father. I'm kind of referred to a fine article written by Randall Turner, who said that dignity is a commodity in prison, something useful and valuable, and in most cases rarely issued to inmates. When my friend and father of four shared his profound nugget of truth with me, it resounded with wisdom born of experience. Nonetheless, he has refused to let his prison experience diminish his role as a father in spite of the difficulties and barriers that all inmates encounter. And so the point I'm trying to make today is that folks who are incarcerated, whatever else is going or has been going on in their life, they still are parents. They are profoundly parents. And whether you can understand or agree with their feelings of responsibility to be parents or not, you certainly must be aware of the fact that the children are still children. And the children have parents who are incarcerated, but they're still their parents. So another little thing I wanted to share with you today. Let's see if I'm getting off my schedule here. I wanted to read something I got off of the Western Prison Network pipeline about preparing your child for a visit to those who are behind bars. So I'm going to read from this, but I think it's all excellent information. If you have a child that you're going to prepare and take them to a Mother's Day visit this weekend, think about some of these things. for an incarcerated parent and caregiver to do before the first visit. Inform the child specifically as to when he or she will be seeing the parent. Give the child a day, a date, and a time that he or she will visit, and indicate how long the visit will be, approximately 1 or 2 hours on the average. And use good judgment as to how far in advance of the visit you inform the child. As a general rule, the younger the child, the closer to the visiting date you should want to tell the child. Younger children have a difficult time putting several days of a week into perspective, so you might want to inform them a day or two before the scheduled visit. Older children usually need more preparatory time and use that time to change their attitude and be ready for a good visit. If the child and parent have had a long separation, it helps for the parent to write the child a letter saying simply that they have missed the child and are looking forward to seeing him. And in the letter, they can describe what you will do together during the visit, or what you will be wearing. Or the incarcerated person should prepare the child by describing a change in their appearance, their weight, their hairstyle, or anything else that your child might notice. And describe the physical environment of the prison in the visiting room, the color of the walls, the arrangement of tables and chairs, and so on, so that the child doesn't walk into this strange place and wonder what's going on here. If the child and parent have had a long separation, it helps for the parent to write the child a letter saying simply they've missed the child and they're looking forward to seeing them. Both the parent and the caregiver should give the child as much information as possible about what to expect on the day of the visit. I'm going to pause from this reading to make it clear that it's really important that visitors are received by incarcerated people. It's really important to hold families together by having children visit their parents. And now when we look at a day like Mother's Day, and everyone in the child's environment is talking about their mother and being with their mother and who they love and this and that, a family tie that has been broken or disturbed by the incarceration of one of the parents is really very fragile, and the only way you can strengthen that is to be sure to arrange a visit to the prison on Mother's Day. Here's a little advice for the caregiver, or the person who's going to be bringing the child on the day of the visit. Remind the child about what they can expect today. Describe the ride to the institution looks like, and what the check-in procedures will be. The more information the child has, and the more he can anticipate, the greater control the child will have over any anxiety that they may be experiencing. Excuse me. Now help the child to identify and label their feelings and offer them some reassurances. For example, I bet you are excited about seeing your mom and dad today, or I guess you might be wondering what you will see there, or you must be wondering what you will talk to your mom and dad about. These types of statements will help the child be prepared for the communication. This is just a little bit of some of the things that you can do. There's lots more, but I think if you're a good, kind, loving, concerned, real person who wants to be a friend to the family, the most important thing to remember about preparing the child is the purpose of the visit is to strengthen the family ties.
Amen.
Hey, I think I hear Bob.
Amen.
And I'm glad to see him. How you doing, Bob?
I'm good. I've got a guest on hold, ready to bring him up.
Well, Bob, I'm going to turn this over to you, and you are going to bring us a fine guest. And thanks all for listening to me, Ruth Kovach. I'll be seeing you next week.
Super, super Ruth.
And like Ruth says, we listen to KBO Prison Pipeline. Thank Ruth very, very much for stepping up to the plate in the Prison Pipeline Collective. We could use maybe one more person in the collective. Ruth and I have been doing this now for a couple months, and we can use one more. And we have a guest coming up on the show right about now. I'll just bring him on up, then we'll talk to him, and you'll see who he is and what he's all about. Guest, are you there?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. How you doing? Blessings.
Blessings to you. Yes, a week and a half ago in Portland, it was a 3-day event at the Holiday Inn Hotel. It was the Oregon Black Political Convention. And I just decided upon myself to go there and learn something and do something different and get some learned. It's only every other year. And We got a young man on the phone with us who came up from Eugene.
Yes.
109 miles up. Go ahead and tell us. Go ahead and tell us who you are, there, brother.
Yes, my name is Shauku Abdul Hafiz, and I'm actually originally from Southern California, San Bernardino, and I'm actually been living in Eugene for the past 2.5 months, attending school, and I'm trying to. I was able to successfully parole from California Department of Corrections parole system here in Eugene, actually. So that's awesome. What I've been up to.
Wonderful. So you're still officially on parole? They got to check in with things?
No. I was actually released off parole January 7th of this year.
Good.
Yeah, definitely.
good, man.
Long journey, yeah.
Long journey. Now, at the three-day convention, what in a nutshell, for the folks who are listening, what it was is we had 3 days of political agenda, the black political, what's the name of that group, Oregon
I
Black?
I guess that they can call it, it's the proverbial term for it, it's caucus, but they call it the black political, I think convention is what they were having it, but it's usually in politic terminology, caucus body, so to speak.
Yep.
And their objective, I guess, is to establish... for Oregon, specifically, the black or the African Americans, what we aspire or would like for certain politicians to represent us, the issues they like for us to represent, like the white down in Washington, different things of that nature, and whatnot. So,
yeah,
you know.
And through the course of the weekend, we'd have a meal here, a break there, but during the whole weekend, we had an agenda and a platform we were putting together. And they already had it written out, and then it was up to us, the delegates, to change it or reword it or get things more direct.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, Mr. Shiruku, he had lots of things to input on on some of the things that were already on paper.
Yeah, totally. It was this issue of becoming more clear, and more, I'm going to use this term very aggressively, but it's kind of a passive term, but assertive. In terms of what we would like to see politicians representing regarding the African American community, as well as, you know, the general American citizens in general, because we know, you know, politicians have a tendency not to reflect our actual opinions of what we like to see happening. So it's just the issue of being more assertive in our language.
And one thing that took me in listening to you speak and share your views over the weekend that you seem to be a self-learned man, I think. I didn't get a chance to go know how much far, but you have a real knowledge of the world and world history. Did you learn that while you were incarcerated?
Yes. I dropped out of school, you know, alhamdulillah, man, like in eighth grade. And when I got incarcerated, I was in and out of juvenile halls here and there. But the case that actually I just paroled off of, I got incarcerated at 17. And was blessed to kind of interact with some solid brothers through my 8-year stint in California Department of Corrections. And like maybe like the second year while I was incarcerated, I kind of got, I was incited by some information that wasn't made privy to me when I was coming up in school.
Mm-hmm.
So, and some brothers started just shooting literature at me, and you know, I kind of just ran with it. You know, it's a typical case when brothers in prison. There's a lot of loved ones that's behind the walls that has a lot to offer, and I was just one of the young individuals that was open-minded enough and probably hurt enough on the inside to want to be trying to heal, and knowledge became that thing that was assisting me in healing. It wasn't the only thing, but it became one of those catapults assisting me in healing.
Yeah. Now, you said you were put in prison with adult men at 17?
Yeah, I was in California. They can actually do it technically like at age 15 now. They passed a law while I was incarcerated. And it may be national, I'm not certain. I know they had a young brother that was talking about he was trying to send a death row out there, and I think somewhere on the East Coast. And he was like, 15, 14, something like that. But in any case, yeah, I was actually in, be honest with you, it's a pretty interesting story. The day that I was supposed to be graduating from high school, if I had stayed in school, was the first day I actually found myself on a prison yard.
Ooh, baby.
Yes.
Oh, baby.
I'm calling home. My little cousin is like, you know, I'm getting ready to graduate. We the same age, like only about like a month difference. So I'm like, well, I just got on the prison yard.
Man, and you were 17, and, you know, but looking at you and talking to you, folks can't know by listening, you're not a big 6'5", 300-pound man who's ready to beat down anybody that comes at you. You're just a regular, slender, healthy brother, 17 years old, in with grown folks.
Yeah.
Grown hardened criminal, sounds like. 8 years, my gosh. You sure came out well. You came out well, brother, let me tell you.
Yeah, I'm gonna share it with you, man. I'm gonna share it with the listeners, man.
Thanks.
It's a lot of beautiful. I'm talking about human beings that's behind them walls, and the system in of itself, man, is not really. They don't have the objective of rehabilitation or any type of serious healing when you think about the social ills that our folks and many other Americans are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the human beings that's behind those walls that have a lot of free time, that have done bad things, and many of them haven't done bad things. Well, they haven't done the crimes they're in prison for. But anyway, there's a lot of human beings, man, brothers, that's behind the walls that's, like, really, really, really motivated and really committed to making sure that they send back out to society individuals that can help, you know, us with our social condition out this way. And I think a lot of us sleep on that. Not many of us, but a lot of us sleep on the fact that our fathers and our sons, they're still behind the walls, but they're still building for us, though.
Okay. I got you. Now, so, Luca, I'm going to share with you, and I'm going to share you, if it's okay, with Ruth. Ruth is here in the station with us. Ruth is a prison advocate for years, and she's been doing things. Her and I shared this show. How you doing, Ruth?
Uh-oh, let me
push some buttons here, try to get Ruth. Okay, Ruth, are you there?
I think I'm here.
There we go.
Okay.
Hey, how you doing, sister?
I'm doing fine. Hey, it's really good for you to share with us, and it sounds like a great event that you and Bob were at.
Oh, yeah, it was pretty solid.
Right, and I'd like to know how you feel about how people are treating you on the outside.
How I feel, I got a pretty unique perspective. Like I said, I was somewhere, I hate to use this term, but I was somewhere trained to kind of like to view things from a perspective of a physician and understand that our society is kind of like not really being developed in a healthy way. So how they view me, I understand that people have biases and they've been conditioned to think, you know, and look at people in negative lights that have been associated with what they define as crime or has been, you know, given the title of being a criminal. And if I was a person that wasn't trying to understand and figure out what they're going through from their perspective, then I'd probably be offended and discouraged by the system and, you know, the attitude that human beings give me when I walk in to get a job or try to rent a home or to rent an apartment or even just anything that it were anything that forces me to disclose that I have been incarcerated. So that's your question.
You know what I'm hearing between the lines when you say that is the reason you get along with people is because you understand them, not because they understand you. Am I reading that right?
Humbly, I would say yes.
It kind of reminds me of when someone has an operation or a sickness or a death in the family, and they go to a friend, and they're devastated, and they say, oh, this terrible thing happened to me. And instead of getting sympathy, what the person says, well, what happened to me was even worse, and they tell them their troubles. And it sounds like you come out.
What about
from,
my story? Yeah.
You're needing some feedback from these people, and instead you're having to comfort them for how they get along with you. It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Man. It's pretty
interesting.
Bad.
I got blessed to get I in Oregon, they have some pretty, you know, like, and it's a good thing in a sense when you speak about the victims and they address like a lot of emphasis on the victims, and which is very, very important. You know, I'm one of those advocates that we need to make sure we take care of people that are being harmed in our society. But it's like it's kind of an imbalance to where they don't really focus on the individuals that have been committed the crime and
right.
They get tossed into the system. And one of the things I used to share with them, I actually ran for vice president out here at Lane Community College and was able to win. One of the things I was sharing with them was like, man, look, you know, as long as we continue to ignore institutionally as well as personally, ignore these human beings that's going to prison, sitting inside of a system that's kind of like marinating this criminal mind state, they return back home. You know, and when they return back home, they become your neighbors. You know, they become the person you're sitting with inside the grocery store that you actually purchase something from the grocery store with,
yep.
The person you have your children, you know, playing with their children. And if they still haven't been healed, because that's what the issue is, healing, it's going to be another victim 9 times out of 10. So that apathy or lack of concern, it's the society's detriment more than anybody else's, man.
Well, you're going to have to give us a report back. We're running out of time right now, but we want to hear you another time because I think you got a lot more to say, and I'm going to let Bob say goodbye, and I'll see everyone next week.
You are so right. This man does that. And, Chiruku, we're going to hang up now. Thank you for being here on such short notice. And
yeah, it's all good. Anytime, brother. Anytime.
You can be part of the station on a regular basis, I hope.
All right, man. Anytime.
Thank you, man.
All right, blessings.
Peace out to you. Okay, hey, like he said, it's all about the learning. There's some folks that are on lockdown now. Listen to that man there. Hey, definitely made use of his time. I'm out of here. Jay's place is up next, and I'm so glad to see Jay's. He's ready to go in a real family manner. Ruth will be back next week from 6:30 to 7. And, hey, Reggae Bob's out of here, and everybody's gone. You can email me at reggaebob@comcast.net. Ruth, can they email you something? You got a web?
Email her here.
She's got email at cable. We're out of here, folks. Jay's place is up next. Thank you for listening. Okay. Bye-bye. Okay. This is community radio. We're going to push a button. Hopefully it's a good thing. And then we'll be back with Jay's place right away.
Come on down to the valley. Shine a light. Bring your prayer.